And now, Virgin Most Powerful Radio is pleased to present Hands-On Apologetics with renowned Catholic author and apologist, Gary Machuda.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Hands-On Apologetics. You have entered into Virgin Most Powerful's Apologetics Dojo, and I am Gary Machuda. I'm glad to be with you today. Got a lot of fun in store for you today because, as you know, in the show, we explore apologetics from all sorts of different angles. And today we have what I believe is a real high-impact Catholic apologist in his own right, Master Apologist Carlo Broussard is going to be joining us. Coming into the dojo, and we're going to continue our discussion about God. And today we're going to talk about an issue that I think every Catholic out there has run into at one point in their life, and that is people that just don't understand why God's important. Why is God important? Why does God matter? And that's the topic for today. Why does God matter? Because people say, well, look, I could be good without God. I'm getting along well in life. You know, the universe hasn't collapsed since I stopped going to church. So, and I'm happy. So what difference does it make whether or not somebody believes in God? Is God this superfluous, you know, item in our lives that we could just discard without any ramifications whatsoever? Well, like a master apologist, Carlo Broussard's going to come in and we're going to talk about that. He's going to show that, yes, indeed, God does matter. And he's going to answer all those great objections. So I can't wait to talk with Carlo. We always have a great time when he's on the show. Like I said, high intensity, you know, apologetics. And also, he's a lot of fun, too. So he'll be joining us after the first break. Also, I want to welcome you, and we're going to do our Finding the Fallacy. Finding the Fallacy for today, by the way, is the appeal to the stone. And we're also going to meet an early church father who is somewhat obscure, but nevertheless has a really, really cool quote. So if you want to impress your Catholic friends, you can bring up his name. His name is Quadrantius. Quadrantius. That is our early church father for today. And so we got a lot of great stuff in store for you. It's going to be a lot of fun. And by the way, you are part of the program. So if, especially when Carl comes on the show, if you have a question or comment, give us a call at 888-526-2151. That's 888-526-2151. And we'll see, you know, we could bring on the show and you could chat with the Master Apologist Carlo Broussard. Or perhaps you have questions or comments or you want to share a scenario, so maybe something going on in your life that you would like to maybe get some advice on, or perhaps something went right and you want to share with others things that they can do or say that can help bring people closer to Christ. Shoot us your email. Love to hear from you. And the Dojo mailbox address is questions@handsonapologetics.com. questions@handsonapologetics.com, all one word, and it goes straight to me. I read every email. I answer every email, and even sometimes I bring them on the show, and we have great discussions for that. And it's time to give a shout-out on those watching via social media, live, Facebook and YouTube. Hello, everybody. Great to see you. Charlie, happy birthday. Thank you for jumping on the forum and listening to the broadcast. It's always great to see familiar names there on the YouTube chat room. And, yeah, we even have some emojis of birthday cakes for you. There you go. All right. Hi, Melody. And also welcome you listening either live through radio, maybe your local radio station, or perhaps you're listening via podcast. And we welcome you as well. And by the way, folks, just in case you can't listen to the whole program, maybe you want to hear the whole interview with Carlo Broussard, but perhaps you have to get back to work or some other thing, you can always listen to the show via the virginmostpowerfulradio.org website. Great website, lots of information, and you can go to our shows click on Hands On Apologetics, and you can access all the programs. So if you are forced not to be able to listen to the whole thing, you can listen to the whole thing at your convenience. And I should also note, there is an even easier way to access the program through the Virgin Most Powerful Radio app, phone app. So you don't even need to go on your computer. You could just download the app and listen to Hands On Apologetics or all the other great programs Virgin Most Powerful Radio produces right there on your phone. You could link it to your car. And instead of listening to jams on your way to work, you can be listening to some really good informative stuff. So, all right. So that concludes our housekeeping chores for today. All right. I should say, maybe not housekeeping chores. Maybe we should call it dojo keeping chores. You know, we got to keep the dojo looking nice and clean, right? And so now that we've done that, let's begin our workout, shall we? Let's look at the finding the fallacy. And the finding the fallacy for today is called the appeal to the stone. The appeal to the stone. It's a weird name, folks, but it is actually a very simple fallacy. In fact, it's not very complex at all. Let me give you the definition. Okay, the appeal to the stone is a logical fallacy that consists in dismissing a statement as absurd without giving proof of its absurdity. Okay, so in a way, you kind of kick the argument away like a stone, right? So and this occurs a lot. You get this everywhere, especially with non-believers. You know, you mentioned the resurrection. Oh, that's absurd. You know, Jesus rising from the dead. Did you ever hear anything so ridiculous? And they move on. Well, you know, that's not a counter argument. Just dismissing something as being absurd is not in and of itself a rational basis to dismiss something. You know, so instead, what you're doing is you're saying, I don't need to give proof. I don't need to give demonstration why it's absurd. I just say it's absurd. That is the appeal to the stone. Quite simple, quite simple. In fact, I think this name, if I'm not mistaken, I believe the name came from Samuel Johnson, who was talking about an English Anglican preacher who was preaching a form of idealism, that everything is an idea, there's nothing material, nothing physical. Life is but a dream in a sense. And Samuel Johnson kicked the stone and said, thus I refute so-and-so. And I think that people looked at that as, well, he's just saying it's absurd. He doesn't need to answer. But I personally think when he kicked the stone, he was trying to show, well, how do you explain experience like me kicking this stone if everything is just an ideal? That's my own personal take. And I believe that's what's behind this really strange title for this fallacy. But nevertheless, just be aware of that. So next time someone dismisses an idea as absurd and not worthy of consideration, point that out. Say, look, you're appealing to the stone. You know, you can't, it's not enough just to say it's absurd. You got to prove that it's absurd. All right. Very good. Well, let's jump to the Meet the Early Church Father. I kind of gave a little bit of tease at the beginning of the program. It is Quadratus. I believe that's how you pronounce it, Quadratus, who flourished sometime around AD 125. So he's a very early church father. He would be within or maybe just after the apostolic fathers. Now, we don't know very much about him outside of a single quote from Eusebius. Eusebius says, when Trajan had reigned in the 19th of 1.5 years, Hadrian succeeded to his sovereignty. And it was to him that Quadratus addressed the treatise comprised of an apology for our religion, because some wicked men had attempted to trouble us. It is still extant and in the hands of many brethren, and in fact, we ourselves have a copy. Okay, so that's pretty much all we know about him. So we're able to fix the dates because Hadrian ruled between 117 and 138 AD, and that narrows the time span. Also, we know that we can even date it closer because Quadratus was a native of Asia Minor and possibly the same Quadratus that's also mentioned later in Eusebius as a disciple of the apostles. Now, that's important, folks. Quadratus was a disciple of the apostles, and Hadrian visited Asia Minor between 123 and 124 AD and again in 129. So we know we have a pretty good idea. It's got to be within those dates, 123, 124, or 129 AD. Now let's jump to the quote, shall we, from Eusebius. Okay, now this is from a quote from that apology that they gave to Hadrian. Okay, so this is Eusebius writing. He says, Quadratus himself reveals the early date in which he lived when he relates the following, which is in his own words. Now he quotes from Quadratus, okay? Quote, the works of the Savior are ever present, for they were true. Those who were cured and those who were raised from the dead were seen not only while being cured or while being raised, but were ever present. Not only while the Savior dwelt among us, but also for a considerable time afterwards he had departed. In fact, some of them have survived to our own time. Now, that is a really cool statement. It comports with what Paul wrote, who basically says when Jesus appeared to the multitude, that many of those are still alive, who saw him in his resurrected body. Well, Quadratus, again, he's a disciple of the apostles. He's writing very early, sometime between 123 and 129 AD, says that not only was people witness these cures or people being raised from the dead, but the cured people and the people who were raised, some of them are still alive while he was writing his apology. Cool stuff from an obscure father, Quadratus. Coming up on the other side of the break, we're going to be chatting with Master Apologist Carlo Brossard, and we'll talk about why God still matters. Don't want to miss it. Stay tuned, folks.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
Now, back to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 888-526-2151. Here's Gary.
Apologetics, we're going to talk about God and why God matters. You know, there's lots of people out there that believe that they can dismiss God, not believe in God, that he's kind of a kind of old object that you can put in your closet and forget about, and life just continues just perfectly fine without them. Well, to help us explore why God still matters, we have Master Apologist Carlo Brossard coming into the dojo. Carlo's a native of Carly, Louisiana. He's a promising music career. He devoted himself full-time to Catholic apologetics. And for more than a decade, he traveled the country teaching apologetics, biblical studies, theology, philosophy. He's published dozens of articles in magazines like Catholic Answers magazine. Of course, everyone here probably knows him through his work on Catholic Answers Live. And by the way, I should also mention that you can get a hold of a lot of Carlo's great work on his own website, which is www.carlobrossard.com. And Carlo, welcome to Hands on Apologetics.
Hey, Gary. Thanks for having me, brother. It's always great to be in the dojo.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the energy level always kicks up a notch when you're on board. Yeah, so this is an interesting topic because we run into this all the time. People say, God doesn't matter. I'm happy. I can right. get along. You know, God doesn't really seem to make an impact in our lives. How would you handle that question?
Yeah, well, it sort of depends on, you know, which sort of statement they're making. I have a DVD at Catholic.com for Catholic Answers Press, Why God Still Matters, where I deal with some of these. So, for example, somebody might say, well, God doesn't matter because science is sufficient to explain the universe. And I think we've talked about that in previous segments. But there are other reasons that people will give in order to say, well, God doesn't really matter anymore. So, for example, they might say, I don't need God, or God really doesn't matter because I can be a good person without God, right? So they appeal to their goodness and being good-natured and thinking or assuming that belief in God is necessary to be good in some way and do good things. Or they might say, I don't need God because I can be pretty darn happy without him. In fact, if I were to believe in God, I wouldn't be happy. Right. So those are sort of two targets, I think. Two distinct targets that we can employ various arrows to shoot at, you know, to take the arrows from our quiver. So if we take, for example, the first one, God really doesn't matter because I can be good without him. That's one of the chapters in my book that's one of the things I deal with in a chapter in my book, Prepare the Way. So what I do in the book is one strategy that we can employ is to acknowledge the kernel of truth in that statement. So Gary, if we were in a conversation, I would simply say, you know, Gary, there's some truth to what you're saying, that you can be good without belief in God, assuming that belief in God is really not necessary to do good things and to be good in some way, because we acknowledge what we call in our Catholic tradition the natural moral law. We acknowledge that there is an order of good inscribed within our human nature that is subject to being discovered by the natural light of human reason. So as rational animals, we're able to analyze and assess what we are as human beings, what is our nature as human beings, and from that be able to determine what is good for us insofar as we're human beings and what is bad for us insofar as we're human beings, whether those things appeal to the rational dimension of our nature or the animal dimension of our nature. And anybody with the natural light of human reason, any rational animal, any human being is able to discover that order of goodness inscribed within our nature and to direct their lives in accord with that order of nature. So I would acknowledge, Gary, if we were in conversation, that, yeah, you can know that taking the life of an innocent human being is a bad thing and thus avoid it and thus be a good person in that sense. You can know that taking people's property and stealing is not good for us insofar as we're rational beings, and therefore direct your behavior in a way that's going to avoid those activities. So there is a sense in which you can be a good non-believer, right? You can be a good person as a non-believer in coming to know that natural moral law. So we're not saying as theists that belief in God is necessary for you to do good things and be a good person in some sense. We're not saying that, oh, because you don't believe in God, you're going to go around bashing people's heads in with a bat. That's not what we're saying. However, with that said, and articulating that half-truth, there's also an element in this argument where we can challenge and say, okay, you say you can be a good person without God, but can you be a completely good person without God? Because think about this, Gary. If God exists and he's the supreme being, our ultimate end or goal to which we are naturally ordered to be in union with him, our goodness, our good character would involve necessarily directing our lives to him. So the natural moral law, that order of good inscribed within our nature, would necessarily involve directing our lives and engaging in behaviors in accord with what's good for us, including worshiping the one true God, right?
Yeah.
Adoring the one true God, directing our lives to the one true God. So though an unbeliever may be able to check off some of the marks of goodness involved in the natural moral law, there's going to be one important checkbox that they can't check, namely directing their lives to God. Now, with that said, that's assuming that the unbeliever comes to know that maybe God exists and makes a positive act of the will to say, no, I'm not going to direct my life to God. And then, of course, that individual would not be good, although might be able to do some good things, would not be of good character because he or she would be willfully thwarting their teleology, right? Thwarting their natural direction to the ultimate good, namely God. And so that brings up the question, well, what about the honest seeking atheist, right? Or the unbeliever? Maybe there's an unbeliever who just hasn't seen the persuasive force of the evidence for God's existence, say in Aquinas's five ways. They're honestly seeking the truth. They're not responsible for their lack of vision of seeing the persuasive force of the arguments. They're not responsible for their lack of belief. Could that person be considered good and even possibly be saved? And of course, the answer would be yes, that, you know, as the Catechism of the Catholic Church teaches in paragraph 2125, Gary, even though we recognize that the rejection of God is a sin against the virtue of religion, objectively speaking, the Catechism says, quote, the imputability of this offense, atheism, can be significantly diminished in virtue of the intentions and the circumstances. So there are certain circumstances, factors that could mitigate someone's culpability for saying God doesn't exist. And we could think of a host of scenarios. Maybe somebody thinks that God is some old man with a beard in the sky on a mountain somewhere. And he said, I don't believe in God. Well, he's rejecting something we would reject as well, right?
Yeah.
Or maybe that individual had a bad teacher in school and they gave him a bad portrait of God and he's rejecting that bad portrait of God or a false portrait. Or maybe he's been abused and so he has emotional trauma that's mitigating his culpability for rejecting God. So all of those things have to be taken into factored in when we're talking about whether that unbeliever is going to ultimately be completely good or not and how God is going to judge that unbeliever's soul. So I think all of that has to come into play in conversation as well.
Yeah, and that's basically applicable to everybody because the three things for mortal sin, you know, it's grave matter, which it would be, but also has to be a human act, a deliberate act of the will, and you have to have not sufficient knowledge.
That's
so
right.
If any one of those three is defective, then you don't have grave sin.
And what the Catechism is recognizing in paragraph 2125 when it's talking about atheism, it checks the grave matter checkbox and saying atheism is grave matter because objectively it's a rejection of God and so it's a sin against the virtue of religion, but it's recognizing it's possible that an unbeliever who embraces atheism may not have full sufficient knowledge or full deliberate consent.
Right. Now it's tough to have them believe in, you know, at least theoretically believe there is a God, and then I can see where there would be a gap of goodness that I need to be directed towards them. What would be a way that you can kind of move them in that direction? Would you suggest maybe like Father Spitzer's,
Transcendentals.
Yeah. Would that be a good way to kind of point to
that?
Yeah.
There are a couple of ways to go about it here, Gary. I think one way you could employ here sort of the moral argument, or you can employ an argument from the desire for happiness, which is sort of Father Robert Spitzer's approach of appealing to the transcendental, what he calls the transcendental desires. So I know we have a few segments, we're coming up on the end of this segment, but we could employ the moral argument in this way, and we can talk more about it on the other side of the break when we take our break. And that is to say, look, Gary, you have just appealed to your goodness as evidence that you don't need God. So in my mind, Gary, I recognize, man, this guy realizes that he needs to be doing good things, right? So you recognize this innate obligation that you experience to do what you perceive to be good and avoid what you perceive to be evil. And that's something that we can start with. That's a starting point to say, you know, Gary, you seem to recognize that you need to do what you perceive to be good and avoid what you perceive to be evil. And I would want you to affirm that first. And I think you would, since you're appealing to doing good stuff as, you know, for your good character. And then we would have to ask, okay, if this imposed necessity or this sort of innate experience of a moral obligation to do good and avoid evil, we have to ask, where does it come from? We acknowledge the existence of this moral obligation. Of course, that requires honest introspection. We acknowledge the existence, but then we have to ask the question, how do we account for the existence of this innate experience of moral obligation, imposed necessity on the will to do good and avoid evil? That source is either going to be personal or impersonal. It can't be impersonal. It makes no sense to say that something impersonal is going to morally bind, as if it's a law, a command, give us a command. You know, it's absurd to say something non-rational can morally bind and impose a necessity upon a rational being to do good and avoid evil. So the impersonal option doesn't make sense. So we're going to have to employ something personal, but on the other side of the break, we'll ask what sort of personal being that is.
Beautiful. It's music to my ears. We were talking with Carlo Brassard. We'll be right back on the other side of the break and finish that point. Stay tuned, everybody listening. Hands on Apologetics.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
This is Jesse Romero. You're listening to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda on Virgin Most Powerful Radio.
Master Apologist Carlo Broussard about why God matters. And by the way, for I've neglected to mention this at the beginning of the program. If you want to check out all the argumentation for this and also the other things that we've talked about with Carlo over the past few episodes, get his book, Prepare the Way, Overcoming Obstacles to God, the Gospel, and the Church. It's available through Catholic Answers at shop.catholic.com. And Carlo, right before the break, we were talking about how can we get non-believers to see that just being good isn't enough. And he gave this great argument that non-believers, if they believe that being good is important, it's an imperative, then we have to figure out, well, where does that imperative come from? It's either from themselves or from outside themselves. If it's from themselves, that doesn't make sense because we're rational beings. So what's the other alternative?
Yeah, so before the break, we articulated the source is either going to be personal or impersonal. Okay. And we argued that it can't be impersonal because the obligation, the imposed necessity that we experience is one of a law. Now, any law, as Aquinas teaches, is an ordinance of reason for the common good made by him who has care of the community and is imposed on others by way of a rule and measure. The point being is that a law presupposes intelligence and volition. Somebody has to know the law and have the will to impose the law. And so this imposed moral law that we experience to do good and avoid evil must have its source in a personal being as opposed to an impersonal being. Okay, now, Gary, we have to ask the question, okay, so is this personal being ourselves or is it someone other than ourselves? And if someone other than ourselves, can it be a human being? And now, so we have to, you know, sort of go through these options. I don't think it can be ourselves, right? We can't really impose a law upon ourselves. We can't really oblige ourselves because obligation involves a debt owed out of justice. Well, if I owe myself the debt, well, then I can easily erase the debt and there's no more debt owed, right? So I can't really bind myself. That doesn't make sense. So it's going to have to be some other personal being besides myself. Now, here's the question. Can that other personal being that's the source of the moral obligation we experience innately, can it be another human being? Or must it be somebody superior to a human being? Well, I would argue that it can't be another human being precisely because all other human beings have the very same nature as me, right? In and of themselves, a human being with, now keep in mind, on supposition, there's no superior being here. On supposition, there's no superior being to the human being. No human being on that supposition is going to have authority over me because we're all equal insofar as we are human beings. No human being has authority over another human being if there's no superior being to invest a human being with such authority, precisely once again, because we all have the same human nature. Because as Aquinas points out, obligation is only had insofar as there is a superior. And Gary, because you're a human being, I'm a human being, I am not superior to you, you are not superior to me insofar as we're human beings. And if there's no superior being above human beings to invest you with authority over me, well, then guess what? You can't oblige me to do something. You can't bestow or impose a law upon me and morally bind me. So it can't be another human being. I like how, you know, the American Trappist monk, Gary Thomas Merton, puts it in his book, The Ascent to Truth. He kind of captures this nicely. He says, and I quote this in my book, Prepare the Way, "In the name of whom or what do you ask me to behave? Why should I go to the inconvenience of denying myself the satisfactions I desire in the name of some standard that exists only in your imagination," right?
Right.
He recognizes that no human being has authority within himself, by virtue of his own nature, to morally bind other humans to do good and avoid evil. So in order to account for the moral obligation, the imposed necessity on our will that we experience to do good and avoid evil, there must be some personal being that is superior to the human community. And now that, so far, we're that doesn't seem to get us too close to God, right? Because it could be like an alien, it could be an angel for all we know. So the question is, can we say anything else? And I think we can. And here's the idea. In order for this superior being to have authority, in order for this superior being to morally oblige us to do good and avoid evil, it's going to have charge of or authority over the human community. So the question is, does such a being have authority over the human community of itself, in which case it would be like a creator or an author of the human community, by which it has authority over the human community? Or does such a superior being have authority over the human community in a derived way by some further superior being, you see? If the superior being has authority over the human community of itself, that would constitute it as the author of the human community. And we have a creator of the human community, and that's pretty darn close to God, right? We could call that God. If the superior being has authority or charge of the human community in a derived way by a further superior being, well, then we're off to a regress. We're off to a series of beings having charge of the human community. And eventually, in order to account for the moral obligation, we're going to have to arrive at a being such that it has charge of and authority over the human community of itself in a non-derived way. So whether we're looking at the immediate superior being or the remote superior being, we have to have some being such that it has charge of and authority over the human community in an underived way. And that, my friend, is a creator or an author of the human community, and thus has the authority to bind the human community to live in accord with the order of good that Creator inscribes within our human nature, and avoid behaviors that are in disharmony with and not in accord with the order of good that this Creator inscribes within human nature. Yeah. And that, my friend, is what we could call, such a being is what we could call God. And so I think this is how one way that we could bridge that gap between the experience that we need to be doing good, right?
Right.
And arriving at a creator that accounts ultimately for that natural innate craving to do the good and the obligation we feel to do the good.
Yeah, why do you suppose that from an experiential level that, you know, we can kind of swim in our own little pond and be happy, you know, with this innate desire to do good and this perception of the law and be totally oblivious to that whole, you know, structure that you just put together about God? You know, for a while I've been trying to come up with an analogy. All my analogies fail, but to me it's almost like you can do science on a simple level while not having any idea of like the high sciences, you know, physics and that. You could still wire a light bulb or, you know, whatever. Yeah. And so you can complete these simple tasks.
Yep.
But, you know, to explain the whole system, to make it coherent, you got to involve everything.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
Perfect. You hit the nail on the head, Gary, precisely because, you know, in philosophy, we would say that God has bestowed upon creatures a real causality, right? So creatures have a real power to be real causes of real effects. Now, ultimately, such creatures cannot exercise their causal power unless they are being actualized and caused by the ultimate cause, the first cause, namely God, right? But because creatures have real causal power, the secondary causes or real causes, as human beings, given our fallen human nature and darkened intellect, we have a tendency to focus only on those secondary causes and not try to go beyond, because we can acknowledge these secondary causes and analyze them without appealing to the first cause. But if we seek to ultimately explain why the secondary causes have the power that they do rather than not, we're ultimately going to have to pose the first cause, namely God. And I think the same is true, Gary, in this scenario with our experience of the obligation to do the good. That's something that's innate within us. It's a part of our human nature. And due to our fallen human nature, we have a tendency to be somewhat content only within the box of nature, right? Within our natural inclination. And we've been trained, I think, unfortunately, in modern culture, to not ask the why question, because we only ask the how. We're so scientifically, modern scientifically inclined, we never ask the big why questions. So we recognize the moral obligation to do good and avoid evil, and we're going to blame you for not doing the good, and we're going to praise you for doing the good. But we never ask, well, where does this obligation come from? Why does this obligation exist within me rather than not? And it's that question that's going to put you on the path to coming to a creator that has charge of and authority over the human community.
Yeah, boy, that's so well put. This is great. I always love having you in the dojo, Carl, because it's like watching Babe Ruth at batting practice.
Well, you're very kind, Harry. Thank you very much. I feel the same way about you, brother, when I listen to you.
You're too kind. We're coming up on a break. I hate to start, but how about on the other side of the break, Carlo? Maybe we could talk about another objection to why God's important, namely, science explains, the world. We don't really need to have God to give an explanation for the things around us. How does that sound?
That sounds great, man. I would love to talk about that.
All right. We're talking with Master Carlo Brassard on Why God Still Matters. You listen to Hands On Apologetics. More to come after the break, folks. Stay tuned.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow, that's 80%. RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
Now, back to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 888-526-2151. Here's Gary.
And welcome back, everybody, to Hands-On Apologetics. And we're chatting with Master Apologist Carlo Broussard. I tell you, this is a great workout session in the dojo today, because we're talking about some very fundamental objections against God, and Carlo's just given us a great apologetic structure in which to answer them. So, Carlo, let me I'll throw this pitch at you, and let's see what you can do with it. Could say to you, God doesn't matter because science is sufficient to explain the universe.
Yeah. Ready, set, go, right?
Have at it.
Yeah, I think that our response is a twofold response, Gary. The fundamental problem with this sort of objection is that science in principle cannot give an exhaustive explanation of the material world in and of itself. And the reason is because science, or at least the modern methods of science, presuppose certain features of the material world that must be real in order for the methods of modern science even to start working, even to work, right? For science to even get up off the ground, there are certain features about the material world that science presupposes. And moreover, secondly, it's these features that are the starting points for theistic arguments. And so consequently, science in principle cannot possibly eliminate the need for God and show that God no longer matters in explaining the universe. So you might ask, well, what are these features? Well, for example, change. Take change. We could start with that. Any sort of scientific experiment that you conduct, you have to presuppose the reality of change. For starters, you're going to go from not having knowledge to having knowledge about the physical world due to the scientific experiment and the results that it produces. That's change. It also, any scientific experiment you're going to conduct, you're going to have to presuppose change in that, for example, let's say we wanted to find out the degree of heat needed to melt wax into its liquid form in a certain amount of time. Well, guess what? You have to assume change is real for the wax to go from a solid state to a liquid state, right? Okay. Right. Now, also, too, this change, science not only presupposes the feature of change, but all of the features of the material things that make change even possible. So take, for example, the wax's potential to become a puddle of liquid wax in a liquid form, right? It doesn't have the potential to become a dog, but it does have the potential to become a puddle of liquid wax. And in order for that potential to be actualized, it's going to have to be actualized by something outside of itself, namely heat. And the wax only has that potential because of the kind of thing it is. So what I'm articulating here, Gary, is we have immanent teleology or final causality, right? The wax inherently, there's something inherent within the wax that's directed to being actualized in the state of a liquid form. It's going to need an efficient cause to actualize that potential. It can only be directed to that actual state of being because of the kind of thing it is. That's formal causality. And the point being, Gary, is that science presupposes this entire metaphysical framework of material things within the world. And if science presupposes these features of the material world, then in principle, science cannot adequately and exhaustively explain the material world. Okay. So that's the first strike against this argument. Science in principle cannot give a complete and exhaustive explanation of the material universe. Moreover, Gary, it's these features of the material world that serve as the very starting points for our theistic arguments, right? So we could take change, for example. That's the starting point or the datum for Aquinas' first way. He calls it motion, but of course, as all philosophers point out, he's talking about motion in the general sense. You can have local motion, moving from one place to another, qualitative motion, a change in quality, or quantitative motion, right? A change in quantity or something. And so it's change that serves as the very starting point for the Aquinas' first way, the argument from motion or the argument from change. And of course, from that experience of motion slash change, we reason to a reality that has the act of being a changer or being a mover in an underived way. An act that it has that doesn't require something else to actualize its activity, right? And so that's an unactualized actualizer or an unchanged changer, or some people would say the unmoved mover, although that has to be nuanced a little bit. Now, think about this, Gary. We also, that's the feature of change. Even the corruptibility of the wax itself as a material thing is a starting point for a theistic argument. The fact that wax is such is a thing such that at one time that wax, that piece of wax did not exist. I guarantee you it didn't exist at the Big Bang. Okay. And there will be a time in the future when it will not exist, however many years that takes for it to go out of existence and corrupt, etc. Well, that fact that the wax is corruptible, we know it doesn't have existence by nature. And if that's the case, in order to account for why the wax exists rather than not, guess what? We're going to have to posit a first cause whose essence is to exist. That's what we call God. Even the potential of the wax to take on or be actualized in a state of liquid form, that inherent tendency, that inherent directedness to a particular state of being or actuality, that's the starting point for Aquinas' fifth way, the argument from intrinsic teleology is what we call that as philosophers. And so notice, Gary, if science presupposes all of these features of the material universe that are the very starting points for our reasoning to God's existence, then it follows that science in principle cannot possibly eliminate the need for God. And so that's why it's unreasonable to say that science is sufficient to explain the universe without an appeal to God.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, so it's basically the limitations of science. And the whole, they also ignore philosophy, you know, the philosophy of science and things that science can't explain because it's philosophical questions.
Yeah, and that's an interesting point too, Gary. You know, like, for example, Lawrence Krauss is known for saying that, you know, there's no such thing as why questions. The only questions to ask are the how questions. And you'll find this among many of the new atheists or popular atheists. And what's driving that is this fundamental rejection of philosophy. You know, even the late Stephen Hawking, God rest his soul, in his 2010 book, The Grand Design, said philosophy is dead, right? And that modern scientists are the torchbearers of truth. But Gary, here's the problem with that. In order to say philosophy is dead or not a worthy pursuit of rational knowledge, you actually are doing philosophy.
Yeah, right.
Because to make the assertion, to make the conclusion, it must be based on some reason, right? And in order to go from a reason to a conclusion or a premise to a conclusion, you're doing philosophy. So you cannot possibly deny the use of philosophy without doing philosophy.
Yeah, that's a good point. Like, what scientific experiment can you do to prove that philosophy is dead?
That's you know, right. That's like, right. If science is the only source of genuine knowledge, and you're saying it's genuine knowledge that philosophy is dead, well, then which scientific experiment did you perform in order to know the truth value of that statement, namely philosophy is dead? There's no method of modern science that you can employ in order to arrive at that knowledge. And so it's not scientific knowledge. And if it ain't scientific knowledge, according to the view of scientism, well, then I guess it ain't real knowledge, in which case you should reject it.
Yeah, very good. Very good. Well, hey, we have about 3 minutes. I know you could do this, Carl. If anybody can do it, it's you.
All right.
How about somebody who just says, look, I'm happy. I'm not a theist. I'm a happy person. I'm good without God. What would you say to them?
I think here is where the wisdom of St. Thomas Aquinas comes into play. And I would simply say, you know what? I acknowledge that you can experience some degrees of happiness. The pleasure of friendship, the satisfaction of physical pleasure, good steak, good wine, as far as occasion, some good food in southern Louisiana, that can bring some happiness, let me tell you, right? So you can experience some degrees of happiness. But here's the kicker. Without God, it is metaphysically impossible to experience complete or perfect happiness, which is a complete satiation of our desire to possess the good. Because we're hardwired to be attracted to the good and to desire to possess it in order to be satisfied and happy. So as long as I recognize some good that's limited and recognize that there is more good to be had, then I'm going to desire that more good. Well, without an infinite good, there is only limited goods, in which case I will perpetually always recognize more good to be possessed and thus perpetually be unsatisfied. It is only with an infinite good, that than which no more good could be had, it's only with that sort of good that we can be completely satiated in our desire for the good. And thus, as Augustine said, our hearts are restless, O God, until they rest in thee.
Yeah, beautiful. Hey, you did it. Perfect time. It reminds me of the old saying, the only thing better than a crawfish dinner is five crawfish dinners, right? It's limited.
Philosophy mixed in there.
Well, hey, Carl, where can people get a hold of your stuff and find out what you're doing?
Yeah, they can go to Catholic.com. My products are at shop.catholic.com, and they can follow my work at carlobrusaord.com, K-A-R-L-O-B-R-O-U-S-S-A-R-D. All of my stuff I do at Catholic Answers is located in one spot there.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. We appreciate it.
Hey, thank you, Gary. It's always a pleasure, my friend. God bless you.
You too. That's Carl Brusaord. Yeah, check out his book, Preparing the Way. He goes through step by step, just dismantling a lot of the common objections that you'll find in regards to belief in God and objections against belief in God. Really great stuff. So you can get that at shop.catholic.com and also check out his website, carlobrusaord.com. All golden stuff, all solid material. Trust me, you will not go wrong. And speaking about not going wrong, we are continuing here with our cavalcade of apologists at Hands On Apologetics. Coming up tomorrow, we're going to have Ken Hensley join us. Ken's going to talk about whether or not, let me put it this way, human dignity, human rights, where do they come from? Is it something that we make or is something bestowed by God? Well, he's going to help us work through those questions. And man, this is the fastest hour in Catholic Talk Radio. I tell you, it just flies, folks. Time for me to shut down the Midwest Command Center here, turn off the dojo lights. Coming up next, the dynamic duo of Catholic Talk Radio, the Terry and Jesse Show, coming at you. And as always, I wish everybody a happy and blessed day. And God willing, we'll see each other tomorrow.
In the 1990s, I lived and worked in Hollywood. But when my wife Betty's mom took ill, we relocated to Orange County. And it was during this time in our lives that I converted to Catholicism. Once my eyes were opened to the truth, I couldn't learn enough about the faith. But I had less free time than ever, especially with a long commute. That's when I discovered the real value of Catholic audio. Listening to cassette tapes transformed my daily commute into a miniature retreat. And that's the beauty of Virgin Most Powerful Radio today. Since the podcasts are archived, you can listen anytime on our smartphone app. I know how listening to Catholic audio can bring you closer to Christ and His Church. So I encourage you to visit the App Store or go to vmpr.org and download the app today. It just might change your life. I'm Matthew Arnold for Virgin Most Powerful Radio.
Virgin Most Powerful Radio, sharing the gospel with clarity and charity.